evening and welcome to Town Square. As always, our conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us tonight, our number is 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, call that number, 941-3689. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. By now, you know at least the bare bones. David Ige is Hawaii's governor-elect. Mark Takai will go to Washington. And the turnaround story of the election was the Maui GMO Initiative's journey from no to yes. Some races were tight. The 47 votes that gave Trevor Ozawa victory in East Honolulu City Council District 4. And then there was the red wave that stopped short of our shores, with the exception of Andrea Tupola's Republican pickup in House District 43. Tonight on Town Square, an election debrief with our regular contributor, political analyst Neil Milner, and our frequent guest, UH political science professor Colin Moore. And of course, you too. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Have you guys recovered?
Wait, I'm writing this down. David Ige won. I'm just taking your notes here.
You were on ITV in that tie.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
They
so you
can't
have
see
to wear
the tie
a tie
on the
now.
Radio.
Right,
no,
exactly.
No. I'm dressed for radio today. Thanks. Good to be here, though.
We see you can all laugh now. See, now you can just sort of decompress.
We fully recovered. Yes. If you talked to us yesterday, I think we were out of things to say.
Well, both of us had to sneak out of the side door so that the groupies weren't there trying to get our autograph at 11:30 at night down in some dark street where the studio is.
But, you know, I almost feel like I'm in the political version of Car Talk with the two of you, Tom Malyatsi.
Yes.
So. But seriously, though, as we're looking at this going, you know, 2 days after the election, any real surprises for either of you as you looked at this? What seemed to be such kind of a quiet and kind of a, dare we say, kind of a dull election?
Well, I think it was. I mean, if you were to do the predictions ahead of time, pretty much everything you thought would happen in a Democratic state that's long been dominated by Democrats, that happened. I mean, with the exception of the loss of Karen Iwana and, of course, the very important win for the anti-GMO folks on Maui, that's pretty much the story. Otherwise, not much change. And the Republican mobilization that we expected might have happened as a result of SB1 really didn't pan out.
Yeah, I think the one thing about the – I agree with what Colin said, and I hope we get back to the Maui thing. But if you only really needed to know one thing to predict the outcome of this election, and that is the relative distribution of Democrats and Republicans in most elections. Party identification is very stable, and it's such a large disparity here that it affects everything else that is likely to happen. I think that the mobilization of the social conservatives wasn't very effective. But the fundamental point, using that fundamental thing again, is just how many you would have to find to overcome the disparity, the mathematical disparity that any Republican has. That it's not just that you could have done a better job mobilizing social conservatives, which is arguable, but that you would need so many votes somewhere that you couldn't be able to do it.
A couple of questions that come out of that. First of all, could there be enough to be able to overturn? I mean, was it just a mathematical impossibility, in which case there was nothing else that could have happened?
It's a psychological possibility that translates into numbers, right? I would say yes. I really think that it is virtually impossible for a Republican to win a high elective office in this state right now, regardless of how good you are. Charles DeJew was a terrific candidate.
That's right.
And Duke Iono, I don't think, is quite as good. But these guys are not the bench. They're the first choice. And when I talked to DeJew primary night, and I said, I thought your problem is, your challenge is that last time you ran a very good campaign. What are you going to do different? And you lost. And what are you going to do differently this time? And he had some optimistic answer. But I think that's the fundamental issue. That is, it's the numbers.
Chime in here.
I agree with Neil. I mean, this is a story of party ID. There just aren't that many Republicans. You'd have to imagine an extraordinary challenge where, you know, perhaps as a result of some scandal, a lot of relatively conservative Democrats decide to defect. And that happens very rarely.
And remember what, when we try to compare it to the wave of Republican success on the mainland, those are little waves. Most of those states, almost every one of those states where there was move toward the direction of Republicans, and Republicans won, are more competitive than this place. So it doesn't take that much, as much to go from a Democratic governor to a Republican governor as it would in this kind of state. I don't want to take away from the Republican wave in some places, Massachusetts, for example, and maybe Illinois, but it's still, this is as non-competitive a state as you can possibly find. So all of this movement has to be a gigantic kind of movement that it's impossible to think about a strategy that can do it.
We talked this morning on the morning show on The Conversation with Pat Psyche. And just to sort of get her take on what had happened and where the GOP goes from now. And, of course, she said a lot of the things that she said before and that you might expect her to say. But I asked her about the fact that, you know, when you field candidates that don't really draw people, in fact, they tend to repel some people. And looking at the Tulsi Gabbard race where she has, you know, Kavika Crowley next to her, as opposed to someone who might have some real chops to be able to say something or add to the race in a substantive sort of way, didn't that detract from it a little bit and make it even more difficult?
Well, I mean, one of the problems, I mean, look, running for office is a very hard thing to do. It takes tremendous amounts of time and money, and it's very difficult to recruit a very high-quality candidate in a race that seems unwinnable, and I think that's what you see in CD2. Look, the Republicans' problem here is not a lack of talent. I think they have some great politicians who are great communicators. I mean, and young and dynamic people like Beth Fukumoto Chang. I think she's one of the smartest members of the legislature. But how would she win statewide elected office? I think it's just it's hard to imagine it unless she decides to switch parties. So it's not that they don't have good candidates. It's that you can't fight these fundamentals.
Who's going to want to run? I mean, the probability, this is a rough estimate, but I'm pretty sure this is what show up. The probability of a Republican, a generic Republican, winning the second district is probably 10% probability.
Yeah.
That's being generous. You don't have any money. The Republican national campaign committees are not going to give any money to a losing kind of race. So essentially what you're doing, there are two things. You might be willing to take it for the team. Or you might have such an important issue that you want to get out that kind of position, which I think is one of the things to their credit that the libertarians do.
That's right.
But you have to think about it not just as a politician, but as the kind of total life of someone. Why would you want to go through all of that for almost no likelihood of success at all? And that's and the lack of success feeds on the lack of success. And so,
aren't we kind of seeing that as we've had all these races been lost?
And that's not just true here. It's true in a lot of non-competitive districts in the country. But this is, as a state, is very non-competitive.
So, I mean, that's a lot of doom and gloom from both of you as far as the GOP is concerned, that they're not able to marshal the forces because they don't have enough of them. And although there's some very good candidates, they don't want to be able to run them if they know they're going to be in unwinnable races.
That's right. It's tough. I mean, and that's just the story of the way politics works here. I don't think it's a lack of leadership. I think Pat Psyche did a perfectly good job with her candidates. I think the candidates were strong candidates. But party ID is something that is very, very stable, right? People rarely change their party ID, particularly people who vote. This is something you decide at a relatively early age, often because this is the party your parents support, and it stays with you. This idea that there's all these independents out there, that's really a myth of politics. I mean, people who are independent are usually closet Republicans or closet Democrats, and people who are truly independent are often what we call low-information voters. They're not folks who really turn out to vote. They're not folks who participate. And, you know, that's just the story. That's the psychology of politics.
And in fact, the national election, a number of pundits were incorrectly interpreting this election as the independents carrying it over. But it wasn't true. About 80% of people who say – there's been a big increase in the number of people who say they're independents, but that's because probably it's psychologically more reassuring in this day and age. But about 80% of people who are call themselves independent regularly vote either in the direction of one party or the other party. You're probably talking about 15-20% who do not. And that, of course, is one of the reasons that Mufi Hanuman had so much difficulty. He has no base. There's no cues. And people who call themselves independent don't think about an independent political party. So he was essentially floating around out there with some negative stuff from being mayor, but also no reason for people to attach themselves to them because they had other alternatives that were much more within whatever frame of reference they use in politics. That is, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican.
If you're just joining us tonight, we're doing an election debrief. Colin Moore is here. Neil Milner, you just heard him a moment ago. And we want to hear from you, too. This whole issue of really, are there independents out there? Are there not? Are you really just a closet Republican or a closet Democrat? Why should we even talk about independence in the first place? We want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I mean, it's one thing to be a gadfly and to put things out there because you can and you don't care whether you're going to win because you know you're not going to. Was that really the purpose of having Mufi Hanneman out there so he could literally say anything?
Well, I mean, that's a question you'd have to ask
I
Mufi.
I did when yeah. he was here a couple weeks ago. And, you know, his point was, you know, we're going to say what we're going to say. We're going to do what we're going to do. And people will have something else to listen to. But it seemed to be no matter what and how well targeted his message was. And when he came out of the debates, he was looking really, really good.
Oh, he sure was.
And people were saying, even people who hadn't liked him years ago and had been very critical of him, saying, well, if you're going to make a choice on the basis of who did well, it would be Mufi.
Well,
but that wasn't enough to carry on.
Well, I mean, if you see debates as something you grade like speech 101 and debate 101,
sure,
it's fine.
Mufi won.
Right, but no, but debates have very little impact anyway. And secondly, he couldn't get his message out as well because of the lack of money. But look how few votes he got. There has to be something more fundamental than that. Why he chose to run is something between him and is the inside of his head. I've said before that I think he's really gone from being a powerful candidate to a flawed candidate to a tragic candidate. And I think that that's what you saw here. He had a set of assumptions about what it would take to win this election. And every one of those assumptions had to be right, and every one of those assumptions
was
wrong.
I mean, and it's not surprising.
Yeah, it isn't. It's got very,
And people have, I mean, we've mentioned this, so I'll talk about it. I mean, along with the media myth of the independent voter, which I think is just something reassuring psychological. I mean,
so
no
you
one,
don't really have to commit. It's the
right.
age of non-commit.
Well, it's the guy sitting and reading 10,000 pages of the Affordable Care
right.
Act. It's
always in some diner in Iowa in the back of the
right.
room. I mean, every year they'll find somebody like this. I mean, and I'm sure voters, I mean, who are listening will say, well, I'm one of these people. And people do exist like that, but they're very rare. But the second myth is the importance of debates. And I'd add actually newspaper endorsements along with this. Look, debates, I think, are important. I think they're important public service. And Mufi did very well in the debates. But let's think about who actually would sit down and watch an hour and a half long debate. These are people who are already very engaged in politics, people who already know how they're going to vote. I mean, it'll either confirm how much you love the candidate or how much you hate the candidate. I mean, well-educated voters, and I think, you know, many people listening to HBR might disagree with that, but it turns out it's true anyway. You're actually you're the least likely to change your mind about anything. The more politically involved and well-educated you are, the more deeply you cling to your pre-existing political preferences.
And look for other people to confirm them.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
All right. We got a couple of callers on the line. If you'd like to join us, now's the time. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to RB calling us from Kailua. Aloha. Thanks for your patience.
Aloha. I am, I guess, one of those rare people. I'm a true independent. I'm not a closet Republican or Democrat. And I've got a quick question, lightning round for you guys. On the morning of Tip O'Neill being made Speaker of the House, where were you?
I can't remember. When was that?
Quick. Where were you?
I was I know I was probably in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, growing up.
Where all were you?
Pardon?
The others. Where were you that morning? Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House.
My mother was probably feeding me breakfast.
Uh-huh. What else?
I was not born.
That morning, okay? And I, congratulating him, I take umbrage at independents being low information. I think the people that are low information are those who do cling to failed parties, like the Democratic Party in Hawaii. People make it a hobby to complain about what it's like living here, yet they don't vote differently. And I did not vote for the Republican or the Democratic candidate. So good luck. They're out there, and we just need to be more of them. Thanks for your time.
No, before you go, Arby, will you stay with us for a second? No, I guess we lost him. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for calling. We appreciate the fact that you came and wanted us to know there are really true independents out there, contrary to a lot of the information that we all read and see.
Well, I mean, there are independent voters. I mean, there are true independent voters the way we think of them. I mean, people who carefully weigh the evidence, sometimes go either way. But my point was, these voters are very, very rare. And we create media myths that say these sort of voters determine the elections. And that's just not true.
They're far greater than they really are.
Look how exceptional Arby is. He was engaged enough to be listening to this show.
Yeah.
No offense, but this show is listened to by highly engaged people in politics.
I don't take offense at that.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm not – yes, I am suggesting your audience is relatively small, right? And it's a public radio kind of audience. The fact that he was listening and that he called and that he articulated a reason for his stuff is three steps higher than the average independent voter. The average independent voter is not going to listen to this show, is not going to have really a justification for being an independent, which he had, and is not really going to have much of an alternative. So
that's the biggest backhanded compliment I've heard in a long time.
Well, but let's face it, that's an important dynamic to understand about this.
All right, we're going to go to Jeff calling us from Kaneohe.
You a front-handed comment.
Thank you. 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you call us from the neighbor islands or the mainland, we want to hear from you too. Aloha, Jeff. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Thanks for taking my call.
A pleasure.
Yeah, I consider myself an independent voter. However, I agree with what the speakers are saying, that generally, if I didn't know anything about the candidate, I would probably vote Democratic on my side. But I often talk to others where I work that are Republican in terms. They say they're independent, but when you talk to them, they ally a little bit more strongly with the Republican. I'll vote over the party line. I would vote for a Republican if I saw something fresh and new from them. My biggest complaint is I don't really hear anything new, you know, or engaging to me, and so I tend to fall with whatever. If they say they're a Democrat, I'm assuming that they have some of the values that are espoused by the Democratic Party. And most of the time, I just hear what's wrong with the other candidate and not what they have to offer to me.
Jeff, I'm going to stop you right there just because we're having some trouble hearing you. I know you're probably in transit, but thanks very much for the call. It makes me think of an email that we got, which we're going to put into tomorrow's conversation. But a fellow who wrote to say, you know, I listened to Pat Psyche this morning, and what nobody seems to really be talking about is that there isn't any compelling reason for me to be a Republican, that the Republican Party is not responsive to my needs or really responsive to the needs of the electorate here in Hawaii. Would you guys want to take that one on?
Well, local Republicans here have, I mean, this is it's a difficult balance. I mean, this is a blue state, relatively socially liberal state, you know, a pro-union state, pro-government worker state. And so they have to be moderate, but they're still Republicans. I mean, they still are tied in with the image that is projected by a deeply conservative mainland Republican Party. And so, I mean, Charles DeJus, the platform for his election, the major one, was, well, we need a member of the majority caucus. We need a member of the Republican delegation. You know, that's about as well as he can do. I mean, but he's a moderate Republican. He's an endangered species in that party. And so it's very difficult, not just here, everywhere. I mean, it's tough to win as a Republican in California and other blue states.
You want to chime into this or you let it go?
Very quickly, just to say, because I think we'll come back to it, there is generally, both in this campaign in Hawaii, but also nationally, this was not really an issues election at all.
Yeah.
This was there. I
is
mean,
this personality?
It was a mandate on Obama.
Obama.
That's showing up clearly.
That was a nice way of saying it was personality?
Well, no, it's skill. It's not personality. It's a perception of what he's doing, which is more than that. Here, you had to work real hard to see big differences between the gubernatorial candidates. Mm. I mean, one of the classic grab-onto words on both sides was public-private partnerships. when in doubt, pose one of those things. This was not an
or tell us why we all have to come together.
Yeah, we all have
balance,
to
balance. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was not a. You can understand why people weren't mobilized here. Whatever the likelihood of success of trying to mobilize on the same-sex marriage thing, that would have been an issues election. The Republicans, for a variety of reasons, made a strategic decision not to run on that. And it, in retrospect, they couldn't have done any worse. But you didn't have any kind of compelling differences of issues here. The governor, the Republican candidate for governor, was a little bit vague about all of it. And Ige basically ran on a competence idea.
Well, we've talked about this so many times. It's so sometimes difficult to find real differences among candidates in a shades of blue state. And looking at that kind of through that lens, did you really expect that there would be any sort of, you know, referenda on Obama here?
No,
I mean, wasn't that just? I mean, that just left us cold. Nobody was going to go there.
Well, there are too many Democrats. His approval rating is pretty high here. His approval rating is what, Colin? Maybe 20 points higher.
Yeah.
It's a 60% approval rating. You don't go attacking someone with 60%.
It doesn't make sense. I mean, he was calling for Mark Takei, right? I mean, they had one radio bit Obama did. I think that was one of the – Mark Takei was probably one of the few people who wanted Obama to do a radio advertisement.
And probably benefited
for him.
From it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. We're going to go now to John calling us from Honolulu. The phone lines are open 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're doing an election debrief. Colin Moore is here, Neil Milner is here, and you too, and we want to hear from you. 941-3689-877-941-3689. Hello, John. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you very much. I got a question for the two panelists. We saw some years ago Frank Fossey realized that he could not win the Democratic Party primary for a national, I mean for a statewide office, namely governor, so he formed his own party. We've seen Mufi do that with the same end result. My question is, do you think Mufi is done as a political candidate, or do you think he's going to do a Nixon, as Nixon did in 62, kind of say, I'm going away, and then arise and run for office again?
Well, I kind of know what these guys are going to say, but Neil, you handle that one because I know you think that he's now turned into a tragic candidate.
I don't know what he would run for. Here's the issue. He doesn't have a strong constituency. That is, there was a lot of distrust for him in the Democratic Party, and the Republican Party is not likely to vote for him when they can find some other viable candidates. He really turned down an opportunity that I think he might have been successful with, which is to win the first congressional district. I think had he run in the primary where it was just a plurality, he may have had enough name recognition. But it's hard for me to imagine that he has a political future, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that he hasn't done well in partisan elections. And there's not an independent party. There's an artifact.
He has no base. There's no place from which to grow.
It's an independent party, and it isn't like you have an organization or that you have other candidates or that you have a platform. It's a way to get yourself on the ballot, and that's a limiting factor.
All right, we've got callers coming in. Everybody wants to be part of this discussion. We hope you do, too. Call us sooner rather than later, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Brian calling us from Honolulu. I'm sorry, Kailua.
Hi, this is Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I guess comment and then my question, but my comment is I would agree. I like to think of myself as an independent voter, but you're right in that I have been voting democratically for probably the last 15 years, although before that I was more on the right and a very steady Republican voter. So my question is more this, and I think you may have answered the last couple of calls, maybe at least thinking at the the gubernatorial level, what would you advise, maybe a Republican candidate or any candidate, on how to run and win? I mean, does it make sense to look at one or two key issues? And my comment to that is, even when I think about it, and I admit I end up voting mostly Democratic in the last few elections, I don't see the points that the candidates make about some of the bigger issues, namely the education and the economy for the state, really coming across and swaying my vote. I would like to think that if the other party, or in this case the Republican Party, had presented an effective argument that might sway me. But those would be the two big issues that I would look Francis for. And to be honest, I didn't at least follow a really convincing argument from either party for the campaigns this year.
All right, Brian. Thanks very much for your comment. Anything that the two of you want to add to that? Because we've taken some of the what he said a little bit earlier, and you don't have to
real
come
fast.
Yeah, real fast.
The Democrats don't have to make it an issues campaign because there's so many of them. And it's such a fraught thing for Republicans to do because when you're this much of a minority party, you're in this kind of dilemma all the time. Do I become more ideological, appeal to the base, make my issues clear, and then appeal to a relatively mm-hmm. small part? Or do I fudge? Do I fudge? And they've chosen the fudging strategy, which doesn't work so well, but it's pretty good. It's likely that the other strategy wouldn't work very well either.
But part of the strategy has been, you know, switch parties. If you want, I mean, people say yeah, just very simply.
That's right. I mean,
you know, if you want to get elected, yeah, be a Democrat. Look what happened with Gabbard. Look what happened.
Karen Iwana was a Republican.
Karen Iwana, right?
Exactly.
And yeah. Same thing happened with, wasn't Gil Riviere also?
Oh, yeah. They were Republicans. So, I mean, so this is the other thing that's happening, right? If you're an ambitious politician in this state, and maybe you try to run as a Republican once, maybe you don't, it makes sense. I mean, that's why a lot of our Democrats are deeply conservative Democrats in some cases. I mean, people who might agree with Republicans on a lot of issues and don't always say it in public. I mean, and I think that that's because it just doesn't make sense. The fundamentals are so much against you as a candidate if you run as a Republican that most who are relatively moderate make the decision to be a conservative Democrat. I mean, one question, you know, which would be interesting to hear from Charles DeJoux is why he himself didn't just switch parties, run it as a Democrat. I'm sure he could have won if he had run as a Democrat.
You know, it's interesting about in this place, it's very much like the South was in pre-1960s, where all of the battles, ideological battles, were fought within one party. What's always frustrated me here is that never gets covered adequately. You talk to legislators by the media. You talk to legislators, and they'll say that's the case, especially the dissidents. But it's not the way that the media covers the nature of the legislature. You don't hear very much about these battles. On some issues you do. I happen to have trouble. If I had to make a list of liberal or conservative, it would be very hard for me. And that's a shame because that's where the action is here. It's harder to cover because you can't sit, you know, you can't sit in the chambers and listen to speeches, but that's where the real action is.
All right. And not necessarily action we're going to see.
I don't think so.
All right. We've got callers on the line. You can join us if you'd like, 941-3689. The phone lines are open, 941-3689, 877-941-3689. If you're calling us from the neighbor islands, and we have Bob on the line from Maui. Aloha, Bob. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. I have a question or more of a comment. I have a comment to throw out to the panelists and see what everybody's opinion is. John Boehner today made a comment regarding if Obama was to try to make an end around on immigration reform, avoiding the House and the Senate, that he would effectively be poisoning the well. And I find that hard to believe coming from the Republicans, as after the day after Obama was elected, they basically got together and said, "All guys, it's our sworn duty to now do as much as we possibly can to thwart this man as long as he's in office." So, you know, I'm all for going forward into the future, but I just find it mind-bogglingly, jaw-droppingly astounding that this guy can, you know, they can play obstructionist for all this time in the past, and then on the day one when they get a little bit of power ahead of them, they say, "You're going to poison the well." And I find this obstructionism for these last several years since Obama got put into power to be more frustrating. And
well, you and a lot of people, I'm sure too. But I'm gonna stop you there and see if either Colin or Neil wants to chime in on that one. I mean, the idea of, you know, the kettle calling the pot black. I mean, that's nothing new. But and maybe perhaps we need to retire that phrase "poisoning the well" along with several other things that don't really mean a whole lot that just keep coming at us over and over again as if somehow they're going to get more meaningful the more we hear them.
But if the larger question is, are we going to continue to see this deeply polarized Congress where everything is obstructed and very little gets done? I mean, I think the answer is yes. I mean, one thing that came out of this election, actually, when they've studied the ideological scores, which they've done, you know, who's more liberal, who's more conservative, the Republicans who got elected are more conservative than, in some cases, the Republicans they replaced. The Democrats who got elected are more liberal than the Democrats they replaced. So there's further ideological divide. Now, I will say this. Now that the Republicans control the Senate and both houses of Congress, there has been research that shows that they might be a little less obstructionist, that the voters might hold them accountable when they control both houses of Congress. So there might be some incentive for Boehner to work with Obama on a few issues, but I'm not terribly optimistic.
Well, it's not like that hasn't been done before. Didn't Reagan have this happen too?
Mm-hmm.
But the parties are more ideological.
Yeah,
the Republicans
exactly.
are clearly more, they're more conservative than they were during Reagan. But this polarization that Colin is talking about has increased. And it's following a trend that exists where you keep electing people who are more conservative, and now the liberals, the Democrats, are more liberal. I don't see any reason why people would expect it to be any other way. If you're a good Democrat, well, let's just use the Democrats as an example. If you're a good Democrat, your idea of compromise and moderation is to get the Republicans to move a long way.
Yeah.
And if you're a Republican, it's the opposite. So there's this kind of vacuous thinking that our politicians, including every one of our congressional delegation, feed into about going to Washington to work toward moderation. I think in small ways you'll see differences for sure. I think all of our delegation is going to have to do some of the important under-the-radar work, making different kinds of relationships and so on, which is really very important. Mm-hmm. But big picture, the Democrats are going to vote together and the Republicans are going to vote together on the big issues because that's what they were chosen to do and that's what the norms have become.
And there are serious costs to not voting with the party.
Oh, yeah. You don't get any power being a moderate.
Yeah. No. You'll never get into leadership. You'll never get support in the election. There's very few incentives.
So in the ears of most people listening, well, this is an unwinnable game and that's all it is, a game.
No, it's
with
not.
With very high stakes.
Yes, but game kind of trivializes it. I don't
right.
like it. And I'm a compromise kind of guy and a fairly moderate sort of person. But I fully understand why it operates this way. Now, I must admit, there are some, let's say, awfully colorful people who will really play on this in ways that are quite different. Ted Cruz.
I knew that's who you're thinking
of. Ted Cruz is certainly one of them, but he's not alone. And that adds a certain animus to it, which, in fact, a lot of the Republicans don't like. But this is basically what you expect, the dynamic that you expect from here. If Charles DeJoux had been elected to Congress, his moderation and attempt to reach out would have been received in a kind of patronizing, paternalistic way. But the real question would have been, how are you going to vote on the big issues? And there would be no question that he's a good conservative Republican on those. He would have voted Republican.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take some more of your calls. Going now to Mike calling us from somewhere on the H1, hopefully on a hands-free set. Mike, you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Only hands-free.
Oh, good.
Yeah, you know, I really hate this thing that we only have two parties to vote for. I think that that's really the problem with trying to govern this country, and that is that you know, with two parties, you're basically saying that you have a choice of A or B, and there's nothing else. And with all the money that flows into politics, that becomes reality. And so my position is that the two-party system is really what's ruining this country and the state of Hawaii. And
Well, first of all, there'd be people who would say to you, we don't even have a two-party system in Hawaii, but I get your point. Thank you very much for the call. You know, are we really going to see a viable third party? I mean,
no.
Absolutely not.
We've seen half-hearted attempts. I mean, if you want more than one or you know, choice of one out of two, you can try Canada because
there's a very fundamental reason why we only have a two-party system here. It's the way we structure our elections.
Right.
It's called
the
Constitution.
Yeah,
the Constitution
exactly.
gives winner-take-all.
Winner-take-all, first-past-the-post elections, just...
That's why I said try Canada.
This is one of the few laws of political science.
That's right. An institutional rule.
This is an institutional rule. It just happens naturally. You get two parties, which is why it is third parties, with a few exceptions, mainly tied up with very charismatic figures in all of American history, have only succeeded, you know, very, very rarely. We're talking Theodore Roosevelt and the Bull Moose Party. I mean, really kind of one-off protests against the two-party system. They've never truly
been successful.
At the state level, right. Socialists at one time got Norman Thomas in a couple of elections got a lot of votes, but that's pretty much it. Look, here's a little story, very quick. The Koch brothers were original libertarians. They were very active libertarians. If they thought that the Libertarian Party could develop, and libertarian is a relatively successful third party. It doesn't win, but it's highly visible. They get their ideas out. if they thought that with all of their millions and millions of dollars, they could build a Libertarian Party into it, don't you think they would do it? Instead, they've decided that it's better to co-opt the Republican Party and put their millions and millions of dollars in there. And that's a good lesson. If you can't do it with the Koch brothers' political savvy and with their money, then it's not likely to happen.
All right, we're going to take a few more callers. Going to James calling us from Maui. Lots of Maui tonight. Glad to hear from you. 941-3689 from Oahu. And again, if you're on Maui, the Big Island, Kauai, you want to talk to us, that's 877-941-3689. Aloha. Thank you for your call, James.
Jason started, I guess, on the phone.
I can anyway, I'm gonna stop you for a second, James. James, I can barely hear you.
Okay, I said I'm really, really, really old, right? So maybe it's hard to hear me. Any case, yeah. I mean, Europe has multi-party systems that work. Everybody else in the world has multi-party systems that work, except us. And it's just trading talking head for another. They don't change, you know. I mean, Obama, who we had great expectations for, and I did myself, he passes the NDAA, you know, the ability to lock people up without trial. I mean, so that's what Bush would have done. These guys are just puppets. Okay? Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, James. Going now to Andrew, also calling us from Maui. All right, I guess we lost Andrew. Andrew, if you're there, call us back. We have Nikhilananda calling us from where? The North Shore of Maui. Sorry, I'm getting a lot of static coming through here. All right, well, we're going to hope that
you... Can you hear me now?
Yeah, now I can.
Okay, yeah, I'm calling from the North Shore of Maui. Well, it's funny, you're getting all these calls talking about third parties, and I've talked to you before, someone who's been active with the Green Party. There's the marginalization that the media does, and I think that's important also, and I don't mean to single you out, Beth Ann, but the questions that you asked when Jeff Davis called, and then on Town Square you had three of the four candidates, and the Maui News said there was a three-way race for governor, not four. And it's like Hawaii does a pretty good job, though, compared to the nation in debates and forums where they do at least at times acknowledge a different party. And Jeff Davis brought out issues that other candidates didn't, that people feel strongly about, whether it's breaking up the monopoly of HECO or whether it's campaign finance reform or, you know, some other issues, that term limits. And here on Maui, I saw a lot of people that, you know, we had an initiative, and that brought out quite a few voters. We were not the lowest county this election, pretty low, but still not the lowest. And there was a lot of people that would support the initiative but voted for all the incumbents and also were afraid to vote for, because they said they were so afraid of Iona, they voted for Ige. Yet, the political positions they hold are much closer to the Green Party or the Libertarian Party. So I think that there's something that the media also has to relate to. And it's true what someone was just saying, and I didn't get who it was, that other countries have multi-party systems. We don't. And as long as we have a winner-take-all system, and on the presidential level, you have the debates are controlled by the Democrats, Republicans, you're not going to get third parties and different alternative positions.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Either one of you want to comment about any of that?
Well, I mean, the reason, as we've said, I mean, the reason we don't have third parties.
I mean,
is,
you don't have to beat this over and over and over again. But I mean, if there's anything that you want to add to something we said earlier about not having third parties or not having other parties. I mean, when you go to Canada and you have provincial parties that have nothing to do with what you see on a federal level, it's a very, very different story because it's a very, very different form of government. We don't have that.
And I do think third parties can play a role, and I think maybe, you know, maybe Jeff Davis did this to some degree here. You know, they bring up issues, and you know, and if they seem popular, if they seem like they're getting traction among the electorate, I mean, the other two parties will try to absorb them. I mean, this is what usually happens with third parties.
But it's one thing to bring up issues; it's another thing to say we have real solutions, and this is how it should play out. And I mean, anybody can bring up an issue.
Well, but let's not pretend that's the reason the media doesn't put them on.
Yeah.
The media doesn't put them into debates because it's not likely that they're going to win. And that's not a bad argument as far as the media is concerned. But if you make the argument that it's not likely that they're going to win, but that they can present some interesting ideas, that politics is not just about winning or losing, even though most of the coverage is, then maybe you can make a better argument. But bottom line is, you could give them all the media attention you wanted, and they would still be very much handicapped because of the two-party system and because it takes so long to get people to move from identifying one party to the other. And remember, almost every independent we talk to today is basically a leaner. There was like a confessional tone in their
voice.
Well, they're very, very much of truly, I vote this way.
Yeah, I know. Thanks for sharing kind of sense. And so there are bigger obstacles than just the media coverage.
Which is to say, though, that still those who are from the Libertarian Party or those who would be independent can still bring issues out and still come up with some solutions, but they know they're probably going to be co-opted by the other parties.
Possibly. That's right, if they get even that close. Well, you can argue that through the Tea Party and the Libertarian Tea Party, a lot of it is the Republican Party is co-opted. You know, the media, the pundits keep talking about the regular Republicans winning out this time, keeping the nut job tea parties out of it. But, you know, your old major professor's argument, Theta Scotchpole, that's not what happens at all. The party has moved to the right.
Yeah.
The party has moved toward the Tea Party positions. So, in a sense, the Tea Party has co-opted the Republican Party.
I want to ask you before we take another bunch of calls here, and we do have a bunch of calls to take, so if you want to get in on the conversation, call us sooner rather than later, 941-3689 from Oahu, or 877-941-3689 if you're on a neighbor island or listening to the live stream. Did you have any issues with the constitutional amendments at all, either one of you looking at them? They polled pretty much the same way we got the results. But some of the interesting things, like looking at the fact that the failure of question three, the one that was looking at the age cap for justices and for judges. You know, I mean, for me, looking at this and thinking, well, a quarter of the Senate is age 70 or over. I mean, these are people like Mitch McConnell. These are people like Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi. There's a whole bunch of them well over age 70.
And we Joe Suki.
I wasn't going to go there. We don't bat an eye when it comes to electing someone to office if they're over age 70, but we say that we have a problem that someone is age 70 and he can't be a judge. I mean, was there any sort of
Well, this is an issue. I mean, I think all the voters probably decided this and realized this was even on the ballot when they saw it in front of them in the polling place. It's not something there was a tremendous amount of discussion ahead of time. And I think, you know, generally voters are biased to vote no with these initiatives, and maybe there is some suspicion that old judges are not making proper decisions. I was surprised at how badly it failed.
I mean, it was landslide land.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am too. But it's so odd in this state. We've elected two senators in their 80s. The governor was elected when he was 74, totally new job at 74. Pat Psyche, the head of the Republican Party, is about 85. But for some reason, we decide that the judges – but that has as much to do with – how the thing is when you present it as a constitutional amendment, it's much harder to get it passed than if you just change change the law through the legislature.
All right, we'll take some more callers. We've got Liz calling us from Kailua. Aloha, Liz. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I think you're the first woman who's called tonight. Thank you.
Yay! Good. Well, I wanted to call in. I live in Kailua, and this year I could not vote or Charles DeJoux, but I did kind of want to correct or comment on his record. So I'm a registered Democrat, although I'm sort of more in the wave of independent millennials, and I'm really concerned about fiscal spending and accountability, particularly within the state of Hawaii government, like unfunded pensions and so forth. But I wanted to comment on Charles DeJoux because he's often referred to as being very conservative, but while he was in Congress during that short time, he voted for things like the DREAM Act and to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And his record shows that he was actually one of the few, I mean, he was like right in the center line.
Well, he says he's a centrist. I mean, he sort of positioned him that way, but the party has moved so far to the right that it's kind of all relative.
Well, I mean, he was for civil unions before a lot of Democrats were for civil unions. So things move, but just 2 years ago, he was, you know, still a centrist. Even the things he stands for today are still
So, Liz, I'm sorry, because I've got a little bit of static coming through my headphones here. Did you say that you did or didn't vote for DeJoo?
I could not because I'm not in District 1. However, he has a record that...
Oh, okay. Oh, all right. Okay. All right. So for you, this was more of an academic issue.
Right.
Okay. All right, Liz. Thanks very much for the call, and thanks for your patience. Going now to Jean calling us also from Kailua. We got a lot of Kailua. We got a lot of Maui calling us tonight. Jean, are you there?
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
So I have a question. How did Linda Lingle get elected governor, considering we're a very blue state?
Well, let's look at that in context. The first question is, why didn't she win in 1998 against a tremendously unpopular Democratic governor when everybody thought that she was going to win? And so that the first thing is to see that even in a situation where a Democrat, an incumbent, was really pretty weak, she was able to lose, basically. You win sometimes. I mean, you're running against a non-incumbent. This is not an ironclad rule. What's interesting, of course, is that Republicans haven't had any success since she ran for the second term. And the second term, frankly, the Democrats couldn't find a decent candidate to run. They ran Randy Awassi, who basically took one for the team. He's a guy who's got a flawed reputation. He's not a great campaigner. And the Democrats had decided it wasn't worth taking on a Republican. And I think partly that was because they were as much overawed by the relationship between Lingle winning and rebuilding the Republican Party. And so they thought that there was much more of a juggernaut out there. So I guess, Colin can disagree. We're not saying a Republican can never win. We're saying it's extraordinarily hard. And since those elections, it's gotten worse for Republicans, not better in the state.
And she also won in a year that had the lowest turnout until last
Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's right, too. You're right.
Yeah, I agree with exactly what Neil said. I mean, it's possible. I mean, if as a result of, in an open seat with no incumbent, perhaps no Democratic incumbent, as a result of some scandal, a particularly poor candidate, I mean, sure, so especially statewide office. I think it's more difficult if you're running for Congress and people know you have to at least be part of that mainland Republican Party. But it's, I think we might see another Republican governor, perhaps.
All right. Well, we'll let that one hang for a second there and tell you that if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open tonight. We're doing an election debrief. You just heard Colin Moore say maybe one day in the future there'll also be.
Well, maybe in his lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah. Not anytime soon.
That was Neil Milner.
Right.
Of course,
right.
You knew
that. I'm
one.
Older.
I'm Beth Ann Costello.
Don't hold your breath.
I hope I'm still alive.
I got to pull these boys apart. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you'd like to join us. Going now to Scott calling us from Waikele. Aloha, Scott.
Aloha. I had a question for the panelists regarding more of on the state legislature side. I wanted to get their thoughts on some of the new crop of legislators that we've got coming in, namely on both sides of the aisle. Really looking at, Takashi Ono, Chris Lee, Kaniala Ng, Justin Woodson on the Democratic side, as well as Lara Matsumoto, Beth Fukumoto, and now unseating Karen Iwana, Andrea Tubuola on the Republican side, and also, I guess, Aaron Johansson as well.
Well, some of those people you named I wouldn't put under the new category at all.
Well, they're newish.
Newish.
Hey, Scott, thanks a lot for asking such a hard question after I spoke at a group that you asked me to and got only lunch. You do raise a good question. I think in some of this I rely on Dylan Anaka. I mean, the bottom line is it's hard to get information on some of these people because they're so new. I think Dylan Anaka is pretty convincing, saying that the young Republicans that are in office right now are really quite good. Good in the sense that they're smart, that they try to walk the line between being principled Republicans knowing that they have to cooperate. And they've done pretty well with younger candidates. And that's about – I don't know that much about some of these other Democratic candidates coming into office right now.
Well, one name you didn't mention, Matthew Lopresti, who's a professor of philosophy at HPU. I mean, I think he's run a good campaign. He's oh, you know, he's thoughtful. But and the two younger Republicans that were mentioned too, I mean, Beth Fukumoto Chang, Lauren Sheep Matsumoto. I mean, they're very good communicators. I think they're very talented. Again, we made this point at the top of the hour. It's not a lack of talent for the Republicans. It's the fundamentals of party ID in the state
and numbers.
Yes, yeah. I mean, we'll see whether they'll ever make the big leap into running. Now, you mentioned Chris Lee, who's been around for a while. Chris, there was a lot of worry in the Democratic circles because an anti-same-sex marriage person was running against them. I always thought that that was exaggerated worry, and Chris Lee just pretty much creamed the guy.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's a young guy, been part of the so-called dissidents for a while. Some of these folks, you know, this is kind of low-key stuff. It's hard to get an overall reputation as a legislator when you first come into office. But I think that, I mean, the quality of the legislators are, I think they're okay. I mean, the ones that I met, they do the work. It's a hard job. They do the work. You may not like their ideology, but you're getting a lot of time out of these people.
All right. Well, we have very limited time left in the show. We want to try to move through some more calls and hear what you have to say, too. Going now to Christina calling us from Maui. I'm sorry, Sue from Honolulu? You didn't tell me that one. Sue from Honolulu. Sorry, Sue.
That's okay. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to actually see if we could talk a little bit about the preschool amendment that didn't pass. I just wanted to see what everybody thought about that and what the future holds now that that hasn't gone through. And from what I've read, it sounds like it's supposed to be a pretty high price tag if it goes through with the DOE to do preschool through the DOE.
All right. Good question. Thanks very much, Sue.
Thank you. I'll take it off the air. Thanks so much.
Well, I'll tell you why I think it didn't pass in part was because voter turnout was low. HSTA opposed it. So did IGE. And the people who most supported it, I think young families, were some of the least likely people to turn out to vote.
And I'll put on my kind of partisan, not political party hat here, and tell why I'm very pessimistic now. I have severe doubts that the state has the will or capacity to pull this off without private partnerships. Almost no other state in the country, and most states have these things for a long time, do it without some kind of involvement with the private school system. If you think about it, it took us 4 years, Governor Abercrombie's entire term, to try to pass the enabling legislation. And during that time, essentially, we went backwards. We got rid of pre-kindergarten. I just don't. And we're talking about the DOE here, and we're talking about a legislature that may be Democratic but is traditionally cautious. I don't see this thing happening for a good number of years if what you mean by happening is actually getting the program
started.
Getting
a preschool on
right, and
the
I
DOE
thought
campus.
That the HSTA and the anti-arguments were pretty facile. I hope I'm wrong because I'm a very strong supporter of this. I'll do what I can to make it work, which is not very much, but I would like to see it work. But I think that's the fundamental problem if you think about how hard it is.
All right, Sue, there's your answer. Now we're going to go off to Christina calling us from Maui. Aloha, Christina.
Aloha, this is Christina. I wanted to go back to what Nikhil Ananda was saying about the, I guess, independent and green candidates and the lack of media coverage. And I guess it was an interesting point that he brought up that if there's less media coverage for the independent candidates, then they're not being covered. Therefore, we're kind of influencing that they can't be seen. And I'm wondering about that because in this last election, I don't know if Maui Council is kind of what we're talking about, but I noticed like a lot of the people that were voting yes on the initiative that would be considered Green Party candidates did get a lot of votes. For instance, I believe Courtney Brooke was like 39%. I'm just off the top of my head. But in that sense, it's like, you know, they weren't by any means like, you know, 5% of the vote. They weren't like inconsequential. They were significant. So I'm wondering about the significance of the media coverage and what that.
Okay, but Jeff
what
Davis.
Say about that?
Like taking Jeff Davis for example, when the Civil Beat had its last poll, they had him at 6%. He polled what, you know, 1.2 or 1.5%.
1.8, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, 1.8, some 1 point well, something in there.
Well, wait a second. This is not 1962 here. I understand. I'm sympathetic to this argument about media coverage. There's social media out there. I mean, there's a whole different way to build exposure now that all political campaigns use. Yeah, sure, it helps to have umpteen million dollars that you can run highly visible ads, you can get on campaigns. But I would trade a place on a debate for a good social media campaign any day of the week. So there is another way of doing this that is not going to make the Green Party or any other third party suddenly successful, but can certainly do some sophisticated networking and building and getting people.
That's true,
to do
but
it.
In talking about the whole issue of time, time is always the master when you're on the media. You don't have just elastic time. And for some who say, how do we get the biggest bang for our buck? Who is the ones that we're that people really want to hear from? And if you keep dividing up the pie, That's the argument that we hear.
The media argument, I don't even want to get into whether the media should put this on or not. I think that's you can go both ways in that. My point here is that there are other ways that you can do it. All of a sudden, these folks are talking as if you
think
don't have
beyond
this
other the
alternative.
Screen. Yeah. If it's a smaller
yeah, look,
screen.
I mean, the Maui GMO issue is a perfect example of this. I mean, or even some of the city council races that were so mm-hmm. close. The most effective way to get supporters and to get people to turn out for you is to knock on their doors. Old-fashioned shoe leather politics still is the best way.
Well, that's what happened in District 4 for the
That's what happened in District 4. I think that was largely responsible on Maui for getting the GMO moratorium passed, despite the $8 million Monsanto and Dow spent to oppose it. So there's plenty of room for that, particularly in this state where the districts are small.
All right, we're going to go to Joel calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Joel. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. I just wanted to ask the panel to see what you think about Hanabusa and her chances in the future. And do you think she would have done well had she chosen to run for governor instead?
Hey, we all get to guess here.
Yeah, I was going
to
say this is the big guess we're not in
right,
your head.
The trouble with future in Hawaii is that there aren't many offices you can run for. You only got two congressional districts. You've got, you know, obviously two Senate seats, that's all. And then you got the governor. Anything else is really pretty minor stuff from her standpoint. I don't know. I don't know what her plans are likely to be. I think there's a good chance had she run for governor,
she would have won.
But from her standpoint, why should she? I mean, she wanted to be senator. She felt that she was entitled, may be too strong a word, but you know what I mean.
But that should have been her path.
Well, it should. Look, politics is as much about optimism and passion as anything else. And we can sit here and say that you should have been more calculated, you shouldn't have been so angry or whatever else. But she thought she could win, and she was plenty peeved that she didn't get.
Well, that's my point. She thought that everything that had brought her to that point said that her path should be
to
Congress.
How off was she? What?
She got darn close to it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, the real question some people are going to say is she going to run against Schatz in the next time?
Yeah.
That's running against an incumbent. An incumbent gets a 5 or 6 point bump, and that gives him a big jump in the next time if she does run. And so that makes it much more difficult.
We're coming to the last part of the hour, just about a minute and a half left. Could you each service look forward to the coming session? And if you think that there's anything that you've seen from this election or from the general way in which we have approached this election that would change how you would ask us to approach the session?
Well, I think what you're going to see from this session is something that David Ige promised. It was one of his biggest selling points, is that he's a legislator. He works well with the legislature. And so there's going to be much less drama. I mean, this is one of the things that I think everyone learned from Abercrombie's historic defeat, was that voters here really don't respond well to these very public fights, this disequilibrium. So I think it's going to be a relatively calm session, but I don't expect there to be anything serious or major pass or happen.
But remember that whoever the governor is, there's a built-in rivalry, and presumably a healthy rivalry between the governor and the legislature. It's true when there's Democrats, it's true when there's Republicans, so you're going to get some of that. If you're asking me what I think the media should do, I would like to see a little bit more coverage of this kind of issue that I'm talking about. What's going on within the caucuses?
The factions.
The factions and the caucuses. Not as gossip, not the way.
No, but maybe so we could actually understand why they are factions.
Get some sense of what the dynamics, yeah. And I think that would be important.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for giving us your hour of time and looking at this. We hope to catch up with you soon. Colin Moore and Neil Milner and all of you, too. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you back here tomorrow morning for The Conversation. Meanwhile, have yourselves a good evening. Aloha.